as Catherine says, Ted gets hysterical when he has to spend his own money.
The government plays more phone recordings at Senator Stevens' trial. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 7th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski spreads the word about tax relief for Exxon Valdez plaintiffs.
To then have to turn a good portion of that over to Uncle Sam just seemed like adding insult to injury.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Wells Fargo, helping customers get to the next stage through banking, loans, and retirement planning. Wells Fargo, the next stage. And by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, providing tax-advantaged college savings options for Alaska families. T. Rowe Price Investment Services Incorporated, distributor, underwriter. Information at 1-888-4, and then Alaska.
Friends of Senator Ted Stevens scheme to manipulate a home repair bill so Stevens wouldn't have to pay for it. That's what jurors heard in a recording played in court today during Senator Stevens' trial. From Washington, APRN's Libby Casey reports.
The jury heard three recordings Tuesday afternoon. Former Vigo CEO Bill Allen is in all of them. He's the government's main witness in this trial. Stevens is accused of taking many of the hidden gifts from him. When Stevens' boiler broke down in January 2006, Allen found a repairman and had him summoned to Stevens' Girdwood house on a weekend night. Stevens paid for the materials, $1,118, but Bill Allen paid more than $1,000 for the labor. 1 month later, Stevens got an invoice from Chugach Sewer and Drain, and it said labor paid by Bill, meaning Allen. Stevens emailed Allen and said he, the senator, needed to pay for it. Bill Allen's secretary, Linda Croft, called Allen on February 16th.
There's an email here from Ted.
What is it?
Basically, he wants to know about that plumbing bill on his place.
Okay.
He said he got a bill from Chugach Sewer and Drain, and it says labor paid by Bill. And he said I should pay those plumbers. So
no, it shouldn't.
Okay, I was just reading at you. So do you want me to fax it to you, or do you want to wait till you come in?
That leads to a conversation later that day between Allen and another friend, Bob Persons. Persons lives in Girdwood, where he owns the Double Muskie restaurant, and acted as an unofficial supervisor to the renovation of Stevens' Girdwood home. Persons was supposed to be the middleman on the invoice. Allen points out the problem, and Persons reacts.
Oh, shit. I didn't even see this.
Persons apologizes for overlooking it.
Oh, labor paid by Bill.
Yeah.
Ouch, I didn't see that. I'm sorry. Well, it went straight to his house.
Yeah, but I got an email from him knowing that he's got to talk to me. And I've already taken care of the deal.
Jeez, I'm sorry, Bill.
Allen says he told the owner of Chugach Sewer and Drain, Charlie Hart, to charge the labor costs to Allen's house. But now this paper trail is a problem, says Persons.
Well, we don't need this thing floating around.
No.
We need to get it from him. We need to get him to the guy at Chugach Sewer and Drain to make that disappear from his records.
Yeah.
Allen and Persons try to figure out how to deal with it. Allen says they could tell the repairman to change it, or Persons says they could tell him it's a mix-up.
What would be perfect is for this guy at Chugach Sewer to believe that Ted paid for the labor as well, and that him writing on this bill that you had paid it was a mistake.
Tell you what I better do. I better get my, I paid for the other part and go down and tell him this is a mistake and redo the whole mother.
Yeah. Tell him that. Just make him understand that Ted's paying for everything.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, that's the safest thing, Bill.
They eventually come up with a plan, have Stevens write Allen a check, but don't cash it.
If it ever did come up, you could say, I didn't deposit that? Hell, I know I did. I don't know where it went.
It's unclear in the recording how much Stevens knows about what his friends are doing. At one point, Persons apologizes because he thinks Allen did not want Stevens knowing about the bill.
And I know you didn't want him to know that, did you?
Well, that, and I didn't want everybody to know,
Well, the only person that knows between me and you and Ted is this guy at Chugach Sewer and Drain.
Yeah, well, he's okay.
Okay, because I haven't talked to him.
I'll just talk to him when I see him.
In another conversation recorded 2 weeks earlier on February 2, 2006, Allen mentions the repair bill, and the two talk about a partnership they have with Stevens in the horse racing business, which Persons says will cost them a lot of money. Persons says he's being extra careful to properly bill Stevens because he's under scrutiny as a senator, and he jokes about comments Stevens' wife made.
Catherine says, Ted gets hysterical when he has to spend his own money. So I want to keep it down, because and the other flip side of that is he gets hysterical because he can't really afford to pay a bunch of money, I don't think.
Government prosecutors quoted this line in their opening statements, saying that Stevens could not afford to pay for a lot of luxuries and so relied on his friends to foot bills. A $1,000 boiler repair might seem minor, but prosecutors say it shows a pattern of Stevens' friends doing him favors off the books. Stevens' lawyers say their client did not know what was going on behind his back. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The four major candidates for congressional seats discussed a wide range of issues last night at the University of Alaska Anchorage. One important subject in the minds of candidates and the audience was the recently approved financial bailout. Incumbent Senator Ted Stevens voted for the plan, saying he had heard from Alaskans who were seeing huge losses in their retirement accounts. His opponent, Democrat Mark Begich, said he too would have grudgingly voted for the bill, adding it still needs improvement, but it's better than the blank check the Bush administration originally asked for. Congressman Don Young voted against it. He said it represents another huge debt that future generations of Americans will have to pay for. And Democrat Ethan Berkowitz gave it reluctant support because failure of the world's markets would have had too great an impact on the state through pensions and business investments. The other hot topic of the forum last night was Congress's role in the nation's future energy needs. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Democrats and Republicans look at energy differently, and voters will have to decide which approach will meet the state's future needs. Democratic Senate candidate Mark Begich says there's no one answer to what Alaskans and Americans need. He says it'll take a comprehensive look at oil and gas and at renewable energy sources, efficiency of design of our equipment, as well as new technology. He said Alaska can be the leader in the field of new energy.
Absolutely, the federal government has a role. It's somewhat amazing to me to see that our delegation has not led the charge over the last 30, 40 years. We would not be in this energy crisis if they saw the future and saw what we need to be doing 20, 30 years ago in developing alternative energy, renewable energy, and long-term domestic production.
While supporting oil and gas expansion, Democratic House candidate Ethan Berkowitz said renewable energy projects offer Alaskans the quickest return on government's investment and would directly benefit our residents.
80 villages could take wind for a total cost of about $150 million. That money would be paid back just in saved diesel in less than 3 years. We have geothermal opportunities that are already working in Chena Hot Springs. Mount Spur across Cook Inlet from Anchorage could generate anywhere from 50 to 150 megawatts of power. That's 10 to 20% of the peak rail belt energy need. Total cost of that is $500 million. We have more tidal capacity in this state than the rest of the country put together. And so we ought to be leading as far as that goes.
The Republican incumbents took a more traditional route to solving energy problems. They called for finding and developing more oil and gas. Senator Stevens said renewable and alternative energy projects cannot be developed unless oil from ANWR helps pay for it. He's been trying to get ANWR open since 1981, while Democrats have stood against it. And he asked Begich what he would do and when he would do it.
Prices in rural Alaska, as you know, are high, as high as $8 a gallon for gasoline. We've got really a struggle for seniors to get the fuel oil in rural Alaska. Tell me this, Mark, when will the climate be right? When will be the climate be right for you to support ANWR? And what are you going to do to change the position of the people that are supporting you from California, New Jersey, and New York?
Begich said he's promised to work to try to get new oil development. ANWR, the Outer Continental Shelf, and the National Petroleum Reserve.
I believe I have the capacity because I don't think people are listening anymore to the debate that Senator Stevens, that you're doing in regards to ANWR. They've tuned you out, to be very frank with you.
Congressman Young also wants to see ANWR open for development. He says he's gotten permission through the House 10 times and once through the Senate before it was vetoed by President Clinton. He says more development of known reserves is essential to the success of any other energy plan.
We are a dependent nation. And if you look at this credit crisis we have today, it's because we didn't produce energy. That's our problem. Energy set this thing off. Housing costs, the lack of productivity, the whole collapse was created because we are now sending approximately $700 billion overseas to countries that are not our friends to buy fossil fuels when we have fossil fuels in this nation.
The Stevens and Begich presentations were videotaped over the weekend and played for the audience. The entire forum will be presented on KTUU television in Anchorage and KTVF in Fairbanks this Sunday night. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood Grand Camp Convention gets underway in Ketchikan.
People starting to figure that this is an important organization, and you know, without this organization, we wouldn't be where we are today.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The 8th Annual Aviation North Expo is happening at the Fairbanks Princess Riverside Lodge October 16th through the 18th. This three-day aviation conference features travel and lodging discounts, FAA certification, a trade show, and networking opportunities. For details and to register, visit aviationnorth.org or call toll-free 877-427-5599. This message sponsored by the Aviation North Expo.
It took a near-complete meltdown of the nation's financial system, but Congress has finally passed tax relief legislation for plaintiffs in the Exxon Valdez oil spill case. The $700 billion Wall Street bailout bill signed by President Bush last week was sweetened with deals for lawmakers across the nation after it initially failed in the U.S. House. One of those sweeteners was Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski's legislation to provide a tax break for fishermen and others who will receive punitive damages from Exxon.
Waiting 18 or 19 years to get your settlement from Exxon is tough enough. But then when you finally receive the settlement check, to then have to literally turn a good portion of that over to Uncle Sam just seemed like adding insult to injury.
Murkowski says the bailout bill was a tough one for her to vote for, but the financial crisis and the EVOS legislation certainly made it easier.
Knowing that the tax extender package, which contained the EVOS amendment in it, knowing that it was all kind of rolled together, perhaps made it easier to say, okay, we need to sign on to this rescue package.
Frank Mullen is a plaintiff and financial planner with Raymond James Financial Services and Homer. He also serves on the board of United Cook Inlet Drift Association and spearheaded the group's lobbying for the tax break.
You know, one of the provisions provides for income averaging, which allows Exxon plaintiffs treat their award as income for fishing purposes over a three-year period. The other part of it that's really beneficial and wonderful is that fishermen can contribute up to $100,000 of their award to an IRA. And last but not least, the requirement for paying self-employment tax is eliminated from the settlement. So those three things are a huge benefit to fishermen who were greatly disappointed in June of this year when the Supreme Court reduced the award by about 80%.
The legislation passed just in time for plaintiffs, some of whom are expecting their first payments this month. According to experts at three local financial institutions, the national economic storm is not wreaking the same havoc in Alaska. At the same time, they warned the Chamber of Commerce audience against complacency. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Joe Beadle, executive vice president of North Rim Bank, says the Alaska housing and mortgage market is doing pretty well when compared to the problems confronting much of the rest of the nation. North Rim's chief lending officer says Alaska has not experienced widespread major devaluation.
In various sectors, the highest end of the market, and maybe on some of those commodity-type condos, there might be some adjustment, and there might be some geographic regions, but Alaska on whole has held its value. Alaska has not lost market value. We have not appreciated in value.
Beadle was one of three bank and credit union senior vice presidents describing and comparing Alaska's economic situation with the nation as a whole. The other two addressing Monday's Anchorage Chamber of Commerce luncheon were Nancy Bear Usera of Alaska USA Credit and Joe Everhart of Wells Fargo Bank Alaska. All three described the state's overall financial health as better than the nation's. Usera said that's partially because Alaska heeded recent history.
We were all here in the 80s. Now, I look around the room, there are a lot of young people who probably didn't live through it. But we learned a lot of lessons in Alaska, both as public institutions and as private institutions, about what can go wrong and how to fix it and what are the right things to do for the long haul.
In the 80s, low oil prices struck hard at the Alaska economy. Many people lost their jobs and homes. Afterwards, the state's major lending institutions began, and stuck to, a more conservative approach to their home loans than evolved outside. Key to that stance, said all three speakers, was Alaska Housing Financial Corporation and its lending practices. Statistics provided by North Rim Bank showed residential foreclosures in the second quarter of 2008 were under 0.5% in Alaska and above 1% in the U.S. as a whole. All three speakers described the healthy liquidity of their financial institutions. Credit is available in Alaska, said Beadle, but nowadays likely at a higher cost, with more equity demanded, combined with the borrower showing good planning and credit discipline. Usera agreed, but added Alaska's fairly solid financial base was no reason for complacency.
There's usually a lag in Alaska in terms of what the impact is in the lower 48. What happens down there, we start to feel in about 18 months. So we really don't know, and we would be not serving you well if we thought we could predict.
Everhart of Wells Fargo said, when looking at the current economy, there are no set rules nor a playbook. Things are changing every day. Everhart pointed to Anchorage's newly opened Dena'ina Convention and Civic Center.
$111 million showpiece for Anchorage, for the business people of Anchorage, for the tourism industry of Anchorage. Do you think that project would be possible in today's market? You know, I don't have a crystal ball, but based upon the market, I don't know if we could sell the bonds, and based upon the rising interest rate environment, I'm not sure that the rate would make the project economical. That is scary.
This is Len Anderson.
A natural gas line rupture at Prudhoe Bay has knocked two production pads offline. BP Alaska spokesman Steve Reinhart says the 7-inch diameter gas line that provides oil production lift violently failed last week.
This was a high-pressure line, so it came apart with some energy. There wasn't any fire or any explosion, and there wasn't a spill, and we're very thankful that no one was hurt. But the loss of that gas has caused us to keep two production pads out of service here for at least the short term.
Reinhart says an investigation is underway to determine what caused the line to fail. Longtime Alaska oil industry critic Chuck Hamill says Prudhoe Bay informants tell him there were a dozen workers in the vicinity of what he calls a scary situation.
When a pipe blows up, explodes, and some of it flies 900 feet into the tundra, that's pretty serious.
Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission numbers show that of the 1,414 oil wells at Prudhoe, only 778 were active last month. Hamill casts some of the blame for the situation on poorly maintained infrastructure, but BP's Reinhardt says the decline is a symptom of the amount of byproduct that has to be managed to draw oil out of the aging field.
We operate different sets of wells in different parts of the field at different times associated with a huge volume of gas production and the need to handle a great deal of water.
A state official confirms that the Prudhoe field is suffering due to age-related production limitations.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by STEMS Floral Artistry and Gifts for Giving. STEMS in Anchorage at 563-3366. Alaska Quarterly Review is recognized as one of the nation's best literary magazines. Among the features of the 2008 issue is Joshua Castile's play Returns, about the war in Iraq from Castile's unique perspective as an interrogator and Arabic interpreter at Abu Ghraib Prison. Copies are available at select bookstores or by subscription. Alaska Quarterly Review is edited by Ronald Spatz and published by the University of Alaska Anchorage. This message sponsored by UAA.
After the Kensington mine laid off half of its 82-person workforce last week, there's been plenty of finger-pointing. Mine owner Core Alaska and its supporters blame federal regulators. Environmental critics say the company has only itself to blame. KTOO's John Ryan reports.
Shortly after Core Alaska announced the layoffs on Thursday, Randy Wanamaker started contacting construction firms, utilities, and other mines to try to find jobs for the 41 laid-off workers.
There isn't much of a demand now, so as far as we can tell, most of these people are going to have to leave Juneau.
In addition to being Juneau's deputy mayor, Wanamaker directs the BBC Human Resource Development Corporation. That consortium of native groups has provided nearly half of Kensington's construction workers. Wanamaker and other tribal officials say they didn't like what they heard at a consultation with the Environmental Protection Agency and other federal agencies back on September 12th. Gordon Jackson is Roads and Transportation Director at the Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. He says the tribal groups were hoping to hear the agency's progress in permitting a plan to dispose of mine tailings in paste form. That was the compromise plan hashed out last year after environmental groups won a lawsuit against the mine's plan to dump waste in Lower Slate Lake.
We were kind of surprised on the September 12th meeting when they brought up one other issue, is dry tailings disposal. Up until then, it was just paste tailings.
In written comments 4 days later, the EPA asked Corps to include more information on the paste plan, including how its impacts compared to earlier plans for dry tailings disposal dating back as far as 1997. Hans Shaw handles the Kensington project for the EPA.
We attempted to have a conversation with the company to clarify that we were not asking for the alternative. And, of course, our request for a discussion went unanswered, and then they made the decision to pull out.
Shaw says until Corps pulled out, the EPA was on track to release the draft assessment of the tailings plan this Thursday. Corps and tribal officials say EPA had promised to release the draft by September, but that EPA repeatedly pushed the schedule back. Hans Shaw says the release would have been just 8 days late, and only because Corps submitted its documents 8 days late.
So it certainly came as a surprise to us when they decided to pull out and pointed a finger to us as being the reason for the delays.
Rob Cadmus with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council says Corps is gambling with Juneau jobs by abandoning the nearly complete paste plan.
It's a much better option than continuing with the appeal to the Supreme Court, causing an unknown amount of delay, and potentially moving forward with a plan that is not as good for the environment.
Federal and state officials say with a 45-day public comment period, Corps could have had final permits for the mine by mid-December. Gordon Jackson with the Tlingit Haida Central Council says the mine would be operating by now if environmentalists hadn't sued to keep tailings out of Lower Slate Lake in the first place.
Oh, I just do hope for the sake of the economy of Juneau and Southeast Alaska that all parties just achieve some kind of final settlement and move forward.
Now that Corps has pulled out of the paste plan, the company is waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to rule on the legality of dumping waste in the lake. That ruling is expected by June. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
The Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood began their Grand Camp Convention today in Ketchikan. They're honoring one of their longtime activists, Walter Sobolev, ANB Grand Camp President Dewey Scan.
You know, we wanted to do this for one of our own that, you know, had a positive effect on our lives and did a lot for the organization, you know. He brought a lot of new ideas to the organization, and he was a very positive influence on a lot of us young guys as we walked through this organization over the years.
Sobolev, a former Grand Camp president, turns 100 this year, and numerous speakers at the meeting will talk about his work in language, culture, and service organizations. Costa Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has more on the annual convention.
On the business side, delegates will hear reports from the Tlingit Haida Central Council, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, and other groups. Convention delegates will also discuss issues of the day and consider resolutions proposing solutions or asking for support. SCAN expects this year's concerns to include education funding, subsistence halibut, and the Sitka sacro fishery. He says energy and grocery costs will also be on the table.
The price of food just been escalating day by day, and I don't know what's causing it, you know. And it's pretty soon our elders are going to have to choose between food and fuel and, you know, electricity. So it's been backed into a corner here.
The Alaska Native Brotherhood was formed in 1912, and sisterhood camps began organizing soon afterward. Membership declined in recent years, down to less than 1,000. That's in part due to competition from contemporary organizations and groups, such as Native corporations and tribal governments. But SCAN says enrollment has almost doubled in the past 2 years to about 2,000 members.
There's, you know, a renaissance of, you know, people starting to figure that this is an important organization, and, you know, without this organization, we wouldn't be where we are today.
What do you think's led to that increase in interest?
Just we've been working hard, you know. And every time I visit somewhere, I ask them to honor someone that's been very influential, you know, in their lives in the ANB and ANS, and they've different camps been doing that.
Delegates and guests from up to 40 ANB and ANS chapters are expected to attend the Grand Camp Convention in Ketchikan. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Casey Kelly and Jay Barrett in Kodiak, and John Ryan and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska Engineering News Fund, whose contributors include Dowell Engineers, providing civil and transportation engineering, land surveying, and planning services, on the web at dowell.com. BP, where now and in the future, it's a priority to hire qualified Alaskans first. And by
First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.